Go.
Right now? Are we on the air, Lady Skill,
yes,
now?
Yes, we are.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hey, yo, bust a move.
Hi, this is Kenny Kramer, the real Kramer, and you're listening to WGXC Acra. And as Cosmo would say, giddy up.
Network, this is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
You've tuned into All Together Now, WGXC's regional look at the news from Hudson Valley and the Capital Region, from the Catskills to the Berkshires and beyond. I'm Tom Rowe, and today you'll hear all sorts of local news updates, weather, interviews, and more, plus community events and the song of the day on All Together Now.
This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the news. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
On air, in air, waves controlled. On air, in air, channel connection. And the moon turns to blood.
WGXC underwriting is provided in part by Kravitz and Son Roofing, a local family-owned and operated full-service roofing company for more than 48 years. Specializing in residential and commercial roof construction, repair, maintenance, and replacement, using high-quality and affordable roofing products. Information at 518-567-4026. Or online at KravitzandSonRoofing.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Fridman Gallery in New York, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
From the WGXC Newsroom, this is the WGXC Daily News. I'm Philip Grant. The village of Coxsackie lifted its state of emergency at 8:30 p.m. July 8th, 24 hours after a major storm blew through, according to a post on the village Facebook page. Five roads remained blocked at that time due to tree removal and Central Hudson's work restoring power. Access to the eastern part of the village, where much of the storm damage is located, is restricted to residents only. Hazardous conditions include hanging wires and unstable trees or limbs. As of Thursday afternoon, crews from five surrounding towns and Greene County, using chipper machines and equipment, assisted in the recovery effort. Coxsackie Mayor Mark Evans said, and I quote, "The goal right now is to make the roads passable," end quote. Central Hudson estimated that a majority of the village would have power returned by late Thursday night. Evans reported that the National Weather Service toured the village Thursday and determined the devastation was caused by a straight-line wind event, not a tornado. The National Weather Service estimated winds neared 100 miles an hour, according to Evans. And because of the rain, there were 264,000 gallons of untreated sewage released into the Hudson River in Coxsackie on July 8th. Storms also downed trees in Stuyvesant and Kinderhook on July 7th, and on July 9th, the remnants of Hurricane Elsa are expected to pass through the area. News10.com is reporting that residents in need of food or supplies can call Coxsackie Police Department at 518-731-8122, 518-731-8121, or at the Village Hall at 518-731-2718. The National Weather Service has issued a flash flood watch for the entire Hudson Valley, and Coxsackie could receive between 1.5 and 3 inches of rain by Friday afternoon. Evans wrote, and I quote, "With this continued bad weather, it just further complicates the repairs and cleanup," end quote. Andrea Mako is reporting for Porcupine Soup. The Durham Town Board has tentatively scheduled a public meeting on a controversial housing development in Cornwallville. On July 6, the board discussed holding the hearing August 31st to receive public comment on the Bosque development. Supervisor Sean Marriott said the location, time, and details for the hearing still needs to be, and I quote, ironed out, end quote. Marriott said, and I quote, I don't think we are going to be able to have a board meeting and public hearing on the same night. I don't foresee that happening, end quote. Marriott said he believes there will be, and I quote, quite a few people, end quote, in attendance, and a second public hearing is likely. Bosque Development, LLC of Hudson, submitted in November its proposal to subdivide 95 acres along Strong and Cornwellville Roads. The project calls for the construction of 12 new high-end homes and a farming operation. Durham does not have a planning board, so the town board serves in that capacity. Public comment has largely been against the development. Dozens of no subdivision lawn signs are posted throughout the town. Community members have various concerns, ranging from environmental and traffic impact to the effect the development will have on the historic character of the hamlet. Marriott said because Town Hall will not be large enough to accommodate everyone for the public hearing, possible alternative locations include the Town Highway Garage or a Cairo Durham school. The board is also considering a time limit on comments, ways to webcast the hearing, and having engineers present to address concerns as they come up. Documents submitted on the project can be found on the town's website. And you can read more about this story at porcupinesoup.com. Chris Bragg reports in the Times Union. Chris Bragg reports in the Times Union that three Republican state ethics commissioners want to get information about a Governor Andrew Cuomo scandal that precedes the COVID-19 pandemic and recent allegations of sexual harassment. Last week, Joint Commission on Public Ethics Commissioner Jim Yates publicly stated for the first time that Cuomo had complained about Yates' vote following the 2019 meeting. Now three state ethics commissioners want an investigation reopened into who illegally leaked that vote information from a confidential meeting to Cuomo, committing a misdemeanor under state law. Yates and Julie Garcia reported the leak to the state inspector general's office. Three Senate Republican appointees to J-COPE, Gary Levine, David McNamara, and George Weissman, now want the state inspector general's office to reopen its investigation into the leak. The J-COPE commissioner said, and I quote, the speaker's New Hampshire, Iowa, and Pennsylvania. New York ranked first in quality of life nationwide. Read the full story in the Times Union. And that wraps up the WGXC Daily News. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, or COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend. Do you have some news to share with WGXC listeners or a special community event you want everyone to know about? You can send press releases on any subject to news@WGXC.org, where they will be shared with all WGXC reporters, hosts, and programmers.
Anyone can also add an event to the WGXC calendar online at wgxc.org/events. Just go to wgxc.org/events and click on the Add an Event button at the top of the page and type in the information about your event. WGXC announcers read these events on the air throughout the day, and internet readers can access them anytime. So please, let WGXC listeners know when you're making news or when you have an event to share with your community.
A posthumous measure of justice for Berta Cáceres. I am Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Catastrophic climate change is heating the planet, shattering records from Siberia to California, fueling wildfires, droughts, and hurricanes. Yet land and water defenders fighting to save the planet face threats ranging from intimidation to imprisonment to assassination. In Honduras, Berta Cáceres was a leader of the indigenous Lenca people's campaign to stop construction of a hydroelectric dam on the Gualcarque River, which they consider sacred. She was gunned down in her home on March 2, 2016. 7 men who carried out the execution were convicted, but the person who ordered the killing escaped justice until this week. On Monday, the Honduran Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, found Roberto David Castillo guilty of ordering the murder of Berta Cáceres. Castillo was the head of DESA, the company that was trying to build the dam. He was a 2004 graduate of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and a Honduran military intelligence officer. His conviction won't bring Berta Cáceres back, but it might deter similar attacks and ultimately save lives. Honduras has long been a virtual colony of the United States, providing bananas, coffee, and minerals for export, produced with cheap labor that's created one of the greatest gaps between rich and poor anywhere in the world. Honduras has also been a base of operations for the U.S. military and CIA from the 1954 overthrow of the democratically elected president of Guatemala to the Contra forces in the 1980s when the U.S. attempted to overthrow Nicaragua's Sandinista government. After he was elected in 2006, former Honduran president Manuel Zelaya, despite being a member of the elite, promoted populist progressive policies like an increase in the minimum wage. On June 28, 2009, Zelaya was ousted in a coup d'etat. Since then, corrupt U.S.-backed right-wing presidents have ruled Honduras, prioritizing privatization of public resources and multinational corporate profiteering. Mass unemployment and increasingly violent criminal gangs have added to the already dire conditions there, driving tens of thousands to seek the safety of asylum in the United States. A vigorous grassroots resistance movement has grown in Honduras, led by workers and indigenous communities. Berta Cáceres co-founded COPING, the Civic Council of Popular and Indigenous Organization of Honduras, in 1993. In 2006, she began organizing against the Aguazarca Hydroelectric Project, successfully driving out DESA's key partner, Sinohydro, the world's largest dam builder. Cáceres was honored for her leadership in 2015 with the prestigious Goldman Environmental Prize. Less than a year later, she was dead. In the wake of her murder, DESA's international funding partners backed out of the project, and the dam remains unbuilt.
Berta Cáceres was someone that, you know, called out the Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration constantly.
That's Pitzer College professor Suyapa Portillo speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
She used to say Honduras is a laboratory for what the U.S. wants to do in other countries, not just in Latin America.
Then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton defended the overthrow of President Zelaya without publicly calling it a coup. In 2012, Vice President Joe Biden met with the first coup president, Porfirio Lobo, reaffirming the, quote, long and close partnership, unquote, between the two countries. Biden was supported on that trip by his advisor, Tony Blinken, who is now Secretary of State. Honduras's current president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, has been implicated in the cocaine trafficking for which his brother, Tony Hernandez, is currently serving a life sentence in the United States in prison.
The role in of the U.S. in Honduras, and the reason we're critical of it, is because it has been a role of extractivism, of racial capitalism.
Professor Siapa Portillo adds,
a role that has never been about respecting the sovereignty of Honduras or other Central American nations. And this is more of the same, right? We're seeing more of the same.
The environmental human rights group Global Witness, in its most recent annual report on attacks against land and water defenders, found at least 212 of these frontline activists were killed in 2019 around the world, and that as the climate crisis intensifies, so do attacks on defenders. Honduras was fifth on the list with the highest per capita rate for murder of environmental activists in the world. This is Berta Cáceres in her 2015 Goldman Prize acceptance speech.
In our worldviews, we are beings who come from the earth, from the water, and from corn. The Lenca people are ancestral guardians of the rivers, in turn protected by the spirits of young girls, who teach us that giving our lives in various ways for the protection of the rivers is giving our lives for the well-being of humanity and of this planet.
The cost of preserving life should not be death. As the climate emergency intensifies, we all have a responsibility to protect frontline defenders like Berta Cáceres. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
We're joined today by David King, who is the relatively new deputy director for the Center for Law and Justice. And I had been struck a couple of weeks ago by the Attorney General and other law enforcement officials announcing that they had really made a major breakthrough in the fight against drugs and guns and weapons in the Capitol District by arresting, 50 people. And then earlier this week, Governor Cuomo launched an unprecedented executive order to set up a task force or take emergency action to deal with what he calls the increase in incidents of gun violence. But I've also seen posts that this is sort of more of the same. So I wanted to welcome David. David, maybe just give, we have Center for Law and Justice on previously, but what is the Center for Law and Justice? And is this something that, these two events, are these really transformative or is this political posturing?
Yes, the Center for Law and Justice is a social justice organization formed in the South End by Alice Green in the 1980s. And it's been doing work serving citizens of the South End and advocating for social justice and criminal justice for 3 decades now. And the center has addressed this issue previously. It's something that I've seen happen in the city, starting back during the beginning of my career as a journalist in 2006. And it's an issue that the center actually issued a study on in 2012 called What Have We Done? Mass Incarceration and the Targeting of Albany's Black Males by Federal, State, and Local Authorities. We see this kind of raid fueled by RICO and similar statutes pretty regularly here. So I don't think this is something new, and I don't think there's any way that officials could call this transformative or even perhaps helpful in reducing gun violence, given that we've seen a number of shootings post these arrests.
And, of course, the people who were, recently arrested, overwhelmingly young people of color. And I also hear one of the complaints that these sort of, made for TV, made for media roundups, basically gets the, lower level drug dealers, which you could largely get by driving down, various urban streets, rather than really going after the people who are sort of really bankrolling and orchestrating the operations. It sort of basically gets the foot soldiers and not the generals.
You see these folks facing quite a lot of time under these RICO statutes that allow them to go after folks for associating, but not for any particular crime other than associating. So the bar is very low for a conviction, and a lot of these folks settle. They come to a deal that still puts them in jail for 10 years or so. And, you know, one of these raids that the center looked at, you know, looked at essentially young African-American men in the city, you know, due to one of these raids in 2012, were facing 600 years in prison total for nonviolent offenses. And that's a lot of young men in the neighborhood, in this community, who are taken away, destroyed families, basically because to get these easy, you know, I don't want to easy arrest, but basically to have these numbers go up and to allow these officials to stand together. You know, I was struck that all of our local officials, whether it's the mayor of Albany, the county exec, and our state legislators, all stood at this press conference very proudly. And I'm concerned by that. I think it's concerning given that we're in this period where gun violence is endemic across the nation. And I think part of that obviously can be contributed to the fact that COVID, the pandemic, shut everything down and gave these kids nothing to do. It wasn't safe for them to go to the places they normally would. Some of them don't have safe homes to go to, and they're left with this sense of hopelessness. So I think rather than arresting people, there are real issues here that need to be addressed. And they can keep arresting young Black men in droves year after year, but it will not change anything. And all it will do is lead to more harm to the community.
Now, when Governor Cuomo came out with his announcement of an executive order, he did talk both about short-term, you know, approaches, but also long-term, which included, you know, things like housing and jobs and medical care, I believe, employment, hopefully. You know, if the governor really was serious about trying to deal with what he calls the violence or, you know, rising crime rates, so historically still at very low levels, you know, what would be some of the solutions that he should be advancing?
Well, you know, look, the governor's mansion, the state legislature, the mayor's office are all on the line there where they can see Arbor Hill. And they've been able to see it they're in the South End. They can see these communities that have been, I think it's like the TU pointed out recently in some great reporting, that these places have been redlined. They've been intentionally destroyed. These communities that lack funding, that lack programs to support youth, lack jobs, don't even have basic grocery stores. There's so much that can be done in terms of building up these communities, dealing with economic justice, dealing with food insecurity, giving these communities after school programs. I mean, these things exist, and there's great programs in Albany, but they need more funding. There needs to be a real serious effort to create structures in the community that will uplift people and give them a sense of hope. Because, you know, I think anyone who is in Albany and lived in Albany for years sees that these kids struggle to find things to do after school, and there are some programs, but there's limited slots, and there's not a lot of intervention. People are doing the best they can with what they can, but if the governor was serious, I think he would start trying to address more of these systemic issues and boost groups that are doing work on the ground.
I just had an interview a couple of days ago with Laura Travison from the South End Improvement Corporation. And so there's, you know, the city's getting, I think, City of Albany getting somewhere over $80 million in federal stimulus. Big push to get at least $20 million of that dedicated to neighborhood revitalization, but particularly housing in the South End and West Hill and Arbor Hill. This seems like it could be a really good opportunity with this influx of federal, you know, COVID relief funds to actually Albany to try sort of a different approach.
Yes. You know, I think what we need to think about here is not, you know, there's going to be a push to say there needs to be equity across every neighborhood, and every neighborhood in Albany needs to have a voice in this. And it might be a little controversial, but frankly, I think that isn't necessarily true. The neighborhoods that need to have the say are the ones that have been most hurt, the most damaged. We've seen the report recently in the Times Union from, I believe it was the University of Albany, that COVID has drastically impacted people of color and Black communities, minority communities, much more than white communities. So I think the resources need to go where they will do the most good, where the most harm needs to be repaired. And that means funding programs that are transformative, not necessarily just handing the money over to developers, but giving it to programs that will be long lasting and right some of these historical wrongs, including, redlining, as we talked about. And also look at more how those funds can go into criminal justice reforms to divert folks from prison, the young folks in Albany, from having to spend great deals of time in prison, and instead getting them back on track to live, lives rather than just tossing them aside as a statistic.
We've been talking with David King, Deputy Director of Center for Law and Justice. David, you want to give us your website, and also quickly, I know you guys have been pushing for a ban on tear gas and I believe some type of commission. Any progress to the city of Albany in that in the last 20 seconds?
We're really hopeful that the council will take, the council members will really consider how this impacted our neighborhoods. I think we've seen that so many people, whether they are at protests or not, face tear gas in their homes, in the streets, and they don't want to live with that fear. So I hope the council will consider what that really means to the residents and realize this isn't just an activist hot topic, but really a concern of people like me who live in these neighborhoods, who don't want to feel like the police are going to resort to this kind of thing. And yes, so we're very hopeful. Our website is cflj.org.
Thank you very much, David King. This was Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
This poem I wrote probably 4 or 5 years ago, because it mentions 5 years ago. And I mentioned many of the people who were on at the beginning of the program, or at the beginning went on the air, and many of whom are not here anymore. But that doesn't mean they weren't a part of the history and that they didn't put in a lot of effort into getting WGXC on the air. So here it goes. About 5 years ago, I learned with great elation that Columbia Green was getting a new radio station. So I decided to talk to the busiest man, a Mr. Tom Rowe, and asked him quite bravely about me having a weekly Irish show. He said, "Why should we have an Irish show on WGXC, Tony Fallon?" So I told him about Kitty Kelly, Tara Gold, and Foster and Ellen. I told him that I had the records by the likes of Carmel Quinn, Paddy Noonan, Richie O'Shea, and even Martin Flynn. We would also play the three tenors who could sing so very loud, as well as Louis Brown, Frank Patterson, and Kenny McLeod. We'd get the touring talent from all the East Durham shows and play the lively jigs and reels in the winter when it snows. I'd mention Kaylee's The Arts Week and Saturday Night Dances, and from Jennifer in the gift shop, get cassettes of Marie Francis. Dermot Henry would sing to us about his mother from Mayo, or that other lovely song about the green hills of Sligo. I play Pat Roper and Mary McGonigal, both of whom of Scottish stock, and often play One Day at a Time and The Lady of Knock. I'd interview guests from afar and take requests on the phones, and when I needed rebel songs, I'd cue up the Wolf Tones. I'd have football and hurling results every Sunday night, and if anybody important was in the garden, I'd mention the fight. Well, he sized me up and said, "You got a good line of baloney, but how can I have a radio show with a host named Tony?" And now the station is on the air and I'm the Irish host. It's also on the net, so I'm heard in Ireland, coast to coast. I put on the first show on WGXC on a February night, and I can tell you firsthand that the host was full of fright. And then to make it worser, I made a whole lot of mistakes, and everybody loved the first song about Killarney's Lakes. Then over the next few days, I got requests to keep the show on going, and with the word of mouth and promotion, the audience kept growing. There are all kinds of programs here of this and that, who knows. They will even tell you how an onion or a potato or a carrot grows. There's great enthusiasm and the Lord bless us and save us. What would we all be all today without Smiling Al Davis? There's Max, Karen, Dharma, and of course there's Joan, who helped me with pronouncements, the computer and the phone. I knew we had a good lineup from the very start, and putting Paul in charge of news was very, very smart. Sarah is behind the scene, and for new memberships is reaching. Galen heads up fundraising, and Kaya and Corey are always teaching. There are lists of others I have left out without bad intention.
Hi, my name's Rick Serrano from Catskill, New York. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, ACRA.
The CARA Historical Society was established in 2009. Our mission is to collect, study, interpret, and preserve the history of the town of CARA, New York, for the educational and cultural enrichment of present and future generations. We love to bring history alive through our programming, such as our Hometown Heroes banner program, our State of the Union dinners, our Victorian teas. Each teach history while having fun. Members receive absolutely free our quarterly journal, the CARA Herald, which is jam-packed with historical articles, pictures, and society news. Everyone, however, can access the CARA Historical Society's Facebook page, which is a treasure trove of CARA history and memories. It's easy to become part of our historical family. Call Sylvia at 518-821-3852 or email the CARA Historical Society at CARO HISTSOCIETY@yahoo.com.
Wave Farm programs are made possible in part by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of Governor Andrew Cuomo and the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program administered by CREATE, the Alexander and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, the Teabacker Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors, including WGXE sustaining supporters, who provide critical monthly support. Thank you.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Dan and Mary Udell of Craryville, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast, July the 8th, 2021. I'm Mike Clifford. Pennsylvania should get some 2020 census data this summer to be used in the redistricting process, but some groups want the state to put an end to what's known as prison gerrymandering.
It's the policy of counting people in prison as residents where they're incarcerated, rather than where they'd otherwise be living. A petition launched on Tuesday asks the panel in charge of redrawing the districts, the Legislative Reapportionment Commission, or LRC, to count the 37,000 people behind bars based on where they're from. Robert Salim Holbrook of the Abolitionist Law Center says prison gerrymandering is a racial justice issue.
Because what you have is prisoners who are primarily from Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Chester, who are making up the bulk or a disproportionate number of the state prison population in Pennsylvania. And these rural white counties benefit from predominantly black and brown areas, from them being counted as residents in these prisons in these rural communities.
In a May LRC meeting, PA House Minority Leader Joanna McClinton, who sits on the five-member panel, called on her colleagues to commit to stopping prison gerrymandering. I'm Emily Scott.
The commission has pledged to hold public hearings this summer ahead of the map-making process. CNN reports last month 130 people died of COVID-19 in the state of Maryland. None of them were vaccinated. That's according to the governor there, Larry Hogan. In addition, unvaccinated people made up 95% of new COVID-19 cases in the state and 93% of all COVID-19 hospitalizations. CNN notes the connection between vaccination status and COVID-19 is not specific to Maryland and is not limited to last month. And after Wyoming's Governor Mark Gordon's legal strategy to export Powder River Basin coal to Asian markets was shut down by the U.S. Supreme Court, conservationists say it's time to face the reality of coal's continued decline and help impacted workers and communities.
Rob Joyce with the Sierra Club in Wyoming says the High Court's decision underscores that Washington and any other state is well within their rights to take steps to protect residents' access to clean air and water.
Wyoming can't afford to be spending taxpayer money on these really long-shot legal battles. That money would be much better spent finding ways to diversify our economy and our tax base and really helping our communities prepare for this transition.
Washington State denied permits for the proposed Millennium Bulk Terminal project on the Columbia River in 2017, citing the Clean Water Act. This is PNS. Washington State farmworkers among the most vulnerable during the Northwest deadly heat wave. Eric Tegenhoff reports as the state feels more effects from climate change. Advocates are calling for greater protections.
Rosalinda Guillen heads Community to Community Development and says there are some obvious threats from extreme heat, such as dehydration. But she adds there are other threats, such as the increased use of chemicals and pesticides on farms to keep them producing the way they do under current conditions.
The biggest threat really for farm workers is the lack of consideration from state agencies and health departments for workplace protections. There's no real effort being made to change production practices.
Community to Community Development wants the state to convene a legislative work session on labor and agriculture this year, before next year's session.
During the 2021 legislative session, Washington State farmworkers won a hard-fought victory for overtime pay. And COVID-19 affected nearly every facet of people's lives, including eating. American Psychological Association research finds more than 60% of adults have reported weight problems during the pandemic. McCall Dempsey is a founder and director of Southern Smash, a program of the Alliance for Eating Disorder Awareness that was founded in Louisiana.
The community that we serve that struggles with eating disorders, really, we saw a significant increase in the pandemic. And that was due to eating disorders thrive in shame and in secrecy and in isolation. And the one thing the pandemic did was isolate us all to our own homes.
Southern Smash has created virtual support groups for folks who are dealing with eating disorders, which has been one advantage of the pandemic. Finally, Mike Bowen tells us farmers all over the U.S. contribute to the nation's food supply, but meat and chicken you buy at the market, well, typically it is processed by only a handful of companies.
The Biden administration says it's poised to announce farmer protections when it comes to market concentration. Among other things, the USDA will be directed to draft rules making it easier for ranchers to file complaints. Gary Werdish of the Minnesota Farmers Union cheers the move, saying while it might not resonate with the general public, it's important action in his industry.
Everybody's the same. Everybody wants to be treated fairly no matter what type of job they are in and how they're working, and the farmer's no different.
He says not only do farmers get paid less for their livestock under a heavily concentrated market, consumers wind up paying more for the final product. Four companies control roughly 80% of the beef market, with similar structures for other commodities.
This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, heard on great radio stations, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is the WGXC News Update. Go to the WGXC Newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about anything in this report. I'm Tom Rowe in Accra. Andrea Macko reports in Porcupine Soup that the federal trial of former Prattsville Town Supervisor Corey O'Hara and local businessperson Stephen Baker for fraud has been delayed again until October. O'Hara and Prattsville resident Baker were charged in November 2019 by the U.S. Attorney's Office with fraud relating to grants to Prattsville to help the town recover from Hurricane Irene damage. O'Hara and Baker were charged with conspiracy to commit wire fraud, and theft concerning a program receiving federal funds. And O'Hara has also been charged with bank fraud and making false statements in a loan application. The trial has been delayed multiple times because of COVID-19. But this time, attorneys asked for the, quote, additional continuance of 90 days within which the parties may engage in plea negotiations, file motions, and prepare for trial, unquote. The storms associated with Hurricane Irene devastated Prattsville and western Greene County in 2011. Both O'Hara and Baker are currently out on their own recognizance.
Read more about this story at Porcupine Soup. Sam Rawdins reports for Columbia Green Media that the Catskill Senior Center reopened July 6th with a new director. Jamie Story is now director of the Robert C. Antonelli Senior Center, which has been closed due to COVID-19 since March 2020. The Senior Center is not completely reopened yet, with sit-down dining back on August 2nd with some new rules, including non-vaccinated attendees wearing masks, reservations made a day in advance, and physical distancing. Story says she is also looking to add services. Quote, I'm open to ideas from the community and from the seniors working with funds from the town and fundraisers, unquote, Story said. Quote, I'm really excited to be here. I've been here about a week, and I have met many wonderful seniors, and I'm looking forward to meeting many more, unquote. Edie Bentley, a senior center patron, said, quote, it's a fun, quote, unquote, to be back. Quote, I'm very happy to see that everybody got through the COVID okay, unquote. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Nicole Davis in the Times Union rounds up all the movie and television productions filming in the Hudson Valley this year. A new HBO Max series, Pretty Little Liars, will shoot in the area through next year on location and at Upriver Studios in Saugerties. The Gilded Age, also from HBO Max, has been shooting this year in Troy. Amy Schumer's Life and Beth was shot locally for Hulu, and Mindy Kaling's The Sex Lives of College Girls, filmed around Vassar, for HBO Max. And White House Plumbers, starring Woody Harrelson, has been filming in the Capital Region and the Hudson Valley. Quote, we're north of $30 million halfway through the year, which is amazing, unquote, said Hudson Valley Film Commission director Laurent Regdeau. There are also new film facilities coming to Orange County and a new soundstage coming to the iPark campus in East Fishkill. Regdeau reports the Hudson Valley in 2021 is on pace to surpass the $46 million the film industry spent locally in 2019. Read more about this story in the Albany Times Union, and read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org. The Wyndham Farmers Market is held every Saturday from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. in front of Wyndham Local at 5410 Route 23 in Wyndham. You can find out all kinds of information about the Wyndham Farmers Market on the WGXC community calendar at wgxc.org, where all sorts of local events are listed. And you can even list your own if you go to wgxc.org and click on Add an Event. You'll be read on the radio, just like the Wyndham Farmers Market, which is held every Saturday through October 9th in front of Wyndham Local with meats, greens, honey, vegetables, and more. That's the Wyndham Farmers Market from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. every Saturday on Route 23 in Wyndham.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work.
Expansion of the Democratic National Committee's I Will Vote initiative. Harris said there's a lot of work to do before the 2022 midterms to counter voter suppression efforts.
This is not only about a national election.